From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with Thomas Hollywood Henderson. His pro football career ended after Henderson became one of the first major sports figures to admit to having a drug problem. Henderson's new book describes his addiction to cocaine and his eventual recovery. Also today, I talk with cartoonist Matt Groening. His syndicated feature, Life in Hell, stars rabbits leading lives of hopelessness and despair. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two albums of Gershwin songs, and language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg discusses France's losing battle to keep our American expressions out of their language. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is former football star Thomas Hollywood Henderson. Around the time of the 1979 Super Bowl, he made the cover of Newsweek. A few years later, he was in prison, a recovering drug addict on sex abuse charges. Early in his career, Henderson thought he had it made. He'd risen from an impoverished childhood in a ghetto in Austin, Texas, to a first-round draft pick of the Dallas Cowboys. He became a star linebacker. With his new income, he started buying cocaine. But what began as a recreational drug became a consuming obsession. It hurt his playing and led to unpredictable behavior. When Dallas coach Tom Landry tried to place Henderson on waivers and offer him to other teams, Henderson quit. He was later picked up by the Houston Oilers and then played with the Miami Dolphins. A broken neck, drug rehabilitation programs, and 28 months in prison have changed his life. Henderson got out of prison last October. He'll never play football again because of his injuries, but he's written a book about his football years, which were also his drug years. It's called Out of Control, Confessions of an NFL Casualty. I spoke to him earlier today from the NPR studios in New York. He described himself as the first NFL player to go public about drugs.
Well, in 1981, I called the NFL office and say, hey, guys, I have a cocaine problem. And, of course, I think there had been cases before me that maybe had alcohol, but they were so hushed up and never went public with it. And, of course, after going into drug treatment in February 1981, I did several national interviews and talking about my cocaine addiction. So it's documented that I went public and sought help for my cocaine abuse. I was the first person to do it.
Why did you go public?
Well, I woke up one morning, my bones were rattling, my nerves were screaming, my nose was bleeding. And I was out of control, and I decided that there's something wrong here. And I guess it took what it took to get me to that point, but I knew that my wife had left me, and my bills were due, and I just wasn't capable of doing what I said I was going to do, and a lot of mood-altering changes were happening with me, and I knew something was wrong. And so I sought to find out, hey, who can help me? How can I look at this thing? I didn't know what to look for, or what treatment meant, or how treatment was going to help me. But I just knew that I needed to confront this addiction.
So you told your team that you were having a drug problem and you wanted some kind of therapy. But it's hard to believe that they didn't figure that out for themselves. Your moods and your tempers were so intense. And as you say, your nose, you had all these scabs in your nose. You were snorting and sneezing and blowing all the time. How could they have not figured it out?
Well, I think that deniability is something that they've stayed with throughout this whole thing and throughout my particular situation. I think that they were ignorant to the facts, or should I say, the symptoms of cocaine use at that particular time. Now they're a lot more informed, and anybody asks for a nasal inhaler, they're suspicious of them now.
Well, one of the reasons is, would you explain how you were using a nasal inhaler during the peak of your drug habit?
Well, one of the points I highlight in my book, Out of Control, is that during Super Bowl XIII, I was having psychotic, paranoid episodes, and I figured the FBI, the CIA, and the KGB were following me, and I took a Vicks inhaler and diluted some cocaine and carried this piece of football equipment out on the field with me. And not to mock football or mock the crowd at the Orange Bowl that day during Super Bowl XIII, my nose was hurting, and I actually anesthetized it with a spray of liquid cocaine into my nose.
I can't figure out how you can play football when you're that high on drugs and when the paranoia is really getting to you. I'm trying to imagine what it's like to think everybody's after you, and then, in fact, to have all these guys running after you trying to tackle you. You know, I mean, it's the perfect game if you're paranoid.
Well, that's a strange dichotomy, putting it that way. The only way I ever played football was with great intensity, and therefore I was never a spectator on the field. I had a job to do, and I tried to do that job very well. So I never had time to be afraid because I was so busy doing what I needed to do.
So the paranoia of the game didn't get to you?
No, never. I can't. The paranoia of the world got to me more than the game did. There were times I knew, for instance, in Super Bowl XIII, that I had talked so badly about the Pittsburgh Steelers and Terry Bradshaw that there was going to be something happening, because a few weeks before that in Los Angeles, Coach Malavasi of the L.A. Rams had put a play in to hurt me. And, of course, the guy missed me, and they missed the field goal as a result of that. And I promptly went to the sideline over there and called him a fat jerk and a cheap shot artist. And then in Super Bowl XIII, they sent a guy named Dirt Winston after me on a punt return. And paranoia was not part of this process, but he knocked the hell out of me. And of course, I started to the wrong sideline after this particular hit. So that was reality. That was not paranoia. That when you say Terry Bradshaw can't spell cat if you spot him a C in the A, and talk about the steel curtain the way I did. But I know today that Terry Bradshaw can spell pass, P-A-S-S, because they whipped our A. Oh, no, go ahead. No.
Well, if you're just joining us, my guest is Thomas Hollywood Henderson, who's written a memoir titled Out of Control, Confessions of an NFL Casualty. You know, I want to get back to something you said earlier, which is that at some point you went to your team and you told them that you had a drug habit. I think this is when you were with the Houston Oilers. What kind of reaction did you get?
Well, I was actually not a Houston Oiler. I was not with any team when I went for drug treatment. I had been released. Well, not released. It was the end of the season. And Bum Phillips was the head coach down there. Of course, he got fired, and of course, I got fired. I didn't get fired. I just didn't get re-signed. So I was really on my own. I had already done my 5 years in Dallas, and I'd done a part-time job out in San Francisco and had finished the year with the Houston Oilers. And this was in the off-season, without a team, without any identification with the team, is when I sought my first treatment. And of course, I never had to talk to a head coach or my particular coach about my problem. I went straight to the NFL office, and I talked to a guy named Charlie Jackson, who's the head of NFL security.
Why did you do that instead of going to a coach?
I didn't have a coach to go to at that particular time.
So what reaction did you get from the NFL?
Well, first I got a vague reaction because what I did to him, I was smoking cocaine while I was talking to this guy over the phone, and I was, you know, taking breaks like going, Charlie, excuse me, I'm smoking cocaine and I'm out of control and I need some help. And that's really the way I did it, that I was really smoking coke when I called him. And I don't know if I was really trying to push the point home how sick I was. And they vaguely said, well, you know, we're going to get you to talk to somebody and we'll see what we can do. And they sent me to see a psychiatrist, and I didn't do very well with this guy looking over his yellow tablet asking me, what was your childhood like, Mr. Henderson? And I got very vulgar and outraged at him, and I'm going, I don't need to be sit here and talked about and talked to like this or analyzed. I need to be fixed. I need to go in a hospital. I need treatment. I'm sick. And I, you know, no one had to tell me at this particular time in my life how sick I was. I knew. I was living it. I was in hell.
So you ended up in a couple of therapy programs.
Yes. And one of the major mistakes I made going through my first treatment in 1981 was that when I got out, I had this terminal uniqueness that I thought that my only problem was cocaine. And, of course, I continued to smoke marijuana and take my little social quaaludes and Percodans and drink beer. And And in less than 10 days, I was back on cocaine again and back out of control again.
Now, during this period when you were in therapy, were you playing too?
No. No, this was in February 1981, and it was, that's not football season. Of course, I was not playing.
You connect the painkillers that you used as a player that were prescribed to you by the sports doctors. You connect that with the cocaine habit that you eventually developed. You don't totally blame it on that, but you do see some connection. What were your early experiences playing professional football with painkillers?
Well, my first experience was my rookie year. Just being 1975, we were playing the St. Louis Cardinals, and I had this helmet. A guy running full speed hit me in the hip with a helmet, and I had this extreme pain in my hip that drew tears to my eyes. I'm not a crybaby. I think this is the first time I'd ever really cried in uniform. And the pain was intense, and they put me on a golf cart and took me to the locker room. It was right before halftime. And the doctors came in and played with my side and told me that they were going to inject some medicine in there. And for the first time in my life, I was injected with Xylocaine and cortisone and Novocaine. And I was given a couple of codeine 4 pills for my mouth. And, of course, those injections into my hip ceased the pain, ceased. I mean, I couldn't walk. I couldn't even get up. But after these injections, the side was a bit a blob, a big piece of fat that didn't exist. No pain existed. And Mike Ditka, who was then the specialty team coach with the Cowboys, came to me and asked me, how was I doing? He said, look, we're going to open up the second half with a reverse. And I got the football and went 97 yards for a touchdown, and I slam dunked the ball over the goalpost. And only a half hour earlier, I couldn't walk. And that left an indelible impression upon my mind with drugs, is that I knew at that moment that drugs were going to be a part of my life and a part of my football playing days.
Did you feel that in a way, although drugs like cocaine certainly weren't condoned, it was hypocritical that the kind of drugs that you were given for injuries were condoned?
I think it is hypocritical of them. I think even alcohol use is critical when people sit around and say, oh, those dopers. I don't understand those dopers. Yes, I think it's very dangerous, but the NFL is a high-stress game. It's a very painful game. And one of the real insecurities that a football player goes through, now, you know, most football players are egomaniacs with inferiority complexes. So one of the real insecurities we go through is the possibility of somebody taking our job. And so we'll go to any length to play, if it's possible. If the muscle isn't torn, if the knee is not totally damaged or the shoulder's not broken, we will do what we need to do, whether it's taping, injections, or whatever to start. Because it doesn't matter what your name is, we never want that guy who plays behind us to step on the field and do a good job and take our job.
You know, in that incident that you just described where you were given Xylocaine and other painkillers, and then you went back in the game and played, did you pay for that a few days later?
Yes, I did. that was on Sunday, and of course, you can never tell what your real injury is until about Wednesday or Thursday when you take these injections, because the cortisone, which has a steroid base, and I didn't know all that time that I was getting steroid shot into my joints. Yes, it comes about around Wednesday or Thursday. You really get the full blunt of it. But what they do, again, say Monday, you go in for treatment. You've had an injury, and of course your side is black and blue, and it's swollen and visibly swollen. The doctors will inject you again as a treatment process. Inject cortisone in there to for the healing process. So you still have these numbifications. I don't know if that's a proper word, that they numb it again and again. And with the ice treatment, whirlpool, ice, and then we come around to the next following Sunday, we get it injected again and wear a pad on it.
Your worst injury was when your neck was broken, which really was the end of your football career. You had a neck injury that you suspected was a broken neck but wasn't diagnosed as such. And then later you had another neck injury that was diagnosed as a broken neck. When you were hit, did you know that this was it? This was like your final football injury and your neck was broken?
I had a good idea because in San Francisco, playing for the 49ers, I had broken my neck in Tucson, Arizona one night, and I knew something was wrong because it had never felt this way. I'd injured my neck several times playing football, and it was always in my shoulders or my traps or way below my ears, which meant pinched nerve or something of that nature. But when my head was hurting under my scalp and I couldn't comb my hair, I couldn't drive my car, and I couldn't get up out of bed because of the neck injury, I knew something was wrong. But doctors in San Francisco contended that it was a sprained neck. And, of course, I wore a neck collar, and several weeks passed, and I got kind of okay. And when I broke my neck again in Miami, and they diagnosed and said, Henderson, you can't play again. You're lucky to be alive. This is a hangman's fracture. You broke the deltoid, the cervical vertebrae number one, and number two is cracked. We don't understand how you're still walking or alive. Most people we see with this are dead. And, of course, laying in that hospital bed in Miami, I knew one thing. I knew that I'd felt this similar pain in San Francisco. I knew that the injury was exactly the same. The area was exactly the same. So I contend that I broke my neck twice. And, of course, the NFL today, they pay me a check every month for total and permanent disability as a result of those injuries. And I should be getting a lot more than I'm getting.
Do you wish that you could still keep playing?
That's a good question. I think I'd like to play on Sunday, but I would never, I wouldn't, for $1 million, I wouldn't sit in a meeting room and watch films and go to training camp and do two-a-days and hit the ground 400 times in 6 weeks. I couldn't do it again.
For physical reasons or because you hate that kind of
for physical
team
and mental.
Play type? Well, I mean, you were pretty arrogant about that. I remember you told one of your coaches to mail you the game plan because you didn't feel like sitting in and hearing about it.
Yeah, they took all the fun away with all these meetings and computerized systems and trying to figure out what they do on third down. And it got so monotonous and so repetitive that it just bored me stiff. And up to a point, I figured, I learn all this stuff, and then I don't have to practice anymore. I'll just kind of stay in condition and play. I didn't like the whole thing. I made more money than my coach, and so I started not listening to him.
My guest is Thomas Hollywood Henderson, and he was an NFL star. His career was ended because of a broken neck and also because of his drug problems. He's written a memoir titled Out of Control, Confessions of an NFL Casualty. We're going to talk more about his life after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is former NFL star Thomas Hollywood Henderson. Let's talk a little bit about what your life was like in prison. I want to ask you about the circumstances of your arrest first. You were arrested on sex charges. You were charged with having a minor, a 15-year-old girl, perform oral sex under with you threatened her at gunpoint. And that's why she performed it, and she had to do it in front of a 17-year-old girl who was in a wheelchair. Now, you mentioned that in your book, but you don't really describe what happened or why, and you say that because of what's called the Son of Sam law, that you're not allowed to make a profit or write a book that will make a profit about the crimes that you've committed. And I guess I'm wondering, what kind of advice were you given when you were writing the book about how to handle the reasons for your arrest?
Well, when we talk about the reason of my arrest, I like to say that there were three people in my house freebasing cocaine, and two people said one person was acting weird and out of order. I think that if anybody looked deep into what actually happened and the characters that were in my house that night, and understand the process of cocaine abuse and crack abuse, my author, my lawyers, and the publishers who did the book advised me that it would not be right to sensationalize or exploit my case. And my story is not about my case. My cocaine abuse took me many places. And one of those places was sexual promiscuity. But I've never had to force, or particularly at gunpoint, anybody to commit any sex act upon me.
So you think you were kind of a sex addict as well as a drug addict?
Oh, very much. I was very promiscuous under the influence of cocaine. And that was one part of my addiction, part of the addiction of cocaine. The seductiveness is a sexual drug. And, of course, anybody who knows anything about crack, and, of course, I know quite a bit about it, knows that in the atmosphere of freebasing cocaine, no one has to force anybody, of course, to do freebase cocaine if they're in that environment. And, of course, no one has to force anybody sexually in that environment. I was charged with a lot of things there. And, of course, I did my time. I was accused of a crime, and I did my crime. And I don't feel, you know, real comfortable trying to explain it or rationalize it. It happened. I did 28 months in prison, and that thing is done.
All of your professional sports life, you had really used your name and your NFL affiliation as a ticket to get things from sex to drugs to being a ticket into really good parties. What about in prison? How did your sports affiliation and your name help you out there?
Didn't do me any good. One of the things they told me when I got into prison was, Hollywood, you ain't got nothing coming. And, of course, I went into prison clean and sober, working on a lot of my problems with drug abuse, alcoholism, sex, and everything else. And I wasn't expecting any special treatment in prison. Of course, in my book, you know that I had to learn a few of the rules and regulations in prison, even being Hollywood Henderson. I had to go through some real tough times of almost getting myself killed.
I think part of what you're referring to is that the first prison you were in was basically subdivided into different gangs.
Yes, yes.
Did you join any?
No. I was able to walk alone and do my thing in prison. I refused to. That's how I got involved in drugs, trying to be a part of. I felt like I could stand on my own 2 feet. At the same time, I just had to know the rules and then know where to walk and where not to walk.
Well, you're a big, tough guy, and I know that you could defend yourself and that you're not the typical person someone would try to attack in prison because they'd know from your reputation that you could defend yourself. On the other hand, you had a broken neck and were probably feeling more vulnerable than you would have. Is that something you thought about much in prison?
Quite a bit. But I would say that I look like I can take care of myself, and probably, you know, I'd fight to my death if my manhood was tampered with. It was a very scary time. You know, prison is a very, very scary place, and the one problem I had in prison was that the only fear I had is that I would die, that someone would kill me in there. Other than that, whether I had a fight or somebody wanted to fight, I always welcomed that. I never tried to shield or be a wimp. I just stood tall and did my time. I got out of prison almost 11 months ago, and I'm doing great.
Well, I can think of another fear you might have had in prison, and that's fear of drugs. You said that you were clean when you got in, but you do mention in your book that there were a lot of readily accessible drugs in prison. And when your liberty is taken away from you, it must be really tempting to try to find some other chemical stimulation.
Well, one of the great gifts that I had going in was that I had met a lot of recovering people in Southern California. And by the time I got to prison, I had 7 months clean and sober, and I had a belly full of recovery, and I had bought the whole process of staying clean and sober, and I knew that anything was possible for me in sobriety. And so I took that into prison with me, and when I got out, I had 3 years clean and sober. But in prison, yes, of course, everybody was, hey, Hollywood, come on over here and smoke this joint with me. Hey, Hollywood, would you like to shoot some of this heroin? Hey, Hollywood, I got some crack. And I was tempted. I was never tempted. People were offering me drugs all the time, and I enjoyed my ability to say no in there and try to let them know about what I'd been through and where drugs had taken me. But I'm glad to say that through all my trials and all my sexual escapades, in my book I talk about the orgies and the menage a trois and the promiscuity that goes along with a sexual addiction. You know, since the Emancipation Proclamation, you know, every slave chooses his master. And in the arena of cocaine use and crack houses and their sexual favors done all the time, and that's just the atmosphere. I have a beautiful wife today of 2 years, and I've, in prison and through my treatment process, I've come to understand my sexuality. I'm grateful today that I don't have a double life sentence, or I didn't murder someone, and I put myself in some precarious situations, but I have a wonderful wife who I love very much, and she loves me, and I have a wonderful marriage today.
You're in the position probably now of having to figure out what your next career is going to be. You can't play football anymore, and that was really the only career-type training that you had. This is something that many athletes have to face when they retire. What are you going to be doing?
Well, you know, I think my career choices are pretty limited, and so I've chose the field of recovery, and that is I'll never lose my amateur status, which means I'm a drug addict and alcoholic every day of my life. One day at a time, I will stay clean and sober. So it will be in the area of a drug rehabilitation and sharing and talking and lecturing over this country, because if people, you know, if education is the best deterrent, then the educator must be somebody who's been there. So I think I'll be in this field of rehabilitation and education.
A few years ago, the IRS took your NFL, your Super Bowl ring, and they auctioned it off for about twice its value. I think they auctioned it off for over $11,000 because you owe the IRS money. Are you going to ever try to find out who bought that ring and buy it back from them?
A guy in Sundown, Texas bought that ring, and I know him very well. I wrote him from prison, and we've been in contact. Yes, that was probably a low. Well, you know, I think the IRS should have took that ring because, you know, that ring, I'd put it up for my bond to get out of jail also. So that ring has stood for a lot of dough, and I'm glad he has it because during the time when I went to prison, I didn't need it, and I didn't think it was right for the Internal Revenue to take my trophy and sell it in a public auction to some stranger who didn't play a down of football. Now, that was a gift to me for my ability to play football for the Dallas Cowboys and win a Super Bowl. And I really protest that and always have. But, you know, what can you do about the IRS? I'm glad to report also that I'm in the midst of an offer-in compromise with the Internal Revenue Service to clean up that debt. Matter of fact, I'm trying to clean up a lot of the wreckage of my past, and part of that is making amends for people I've hurt and the things I've done in my past.
So you're not going to try to buy back the ring?
I have a feeling I will have my ring back someday.
Okay. Thomas Hollywood Henderson, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me today.
My guest has been former football star Thomas Hollywood Henderson, who's written a memoir of his life. It's titled Out of Control, Confessions of an NFL Casualty, and it's just been published by Putnam. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Bruce Chatwin. He's written about his travels around the world in his book, In Patagonia. His new book, Songlines, is about the nomadic life of Australia's Aborigines. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, Life in Hell. Cartoonist Matt Groening laughs at broken hearts, shattered dreams, and dismal futures. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews two new albums of the songs of George and Ira Gershwin. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines the growing invasion of English words into the French vocabulary. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. George Gershwin is considered a major composer in the worlds of both classical and popular music. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, has a review of two new Angel recordings of Gershwin music. One features the songs of George and his brother Ira, sung by opera star Dame Kiri Takanawa, with John McGlynn conducting the new Princess Theater Orchestra. McGlynn also conducts this orchestra in the second album of Gershwin overtures and film music. Lloyd thinks one of these albums rings true, and the other doesn't.
Angel Records, which has given us some of the greatest opera recordings ever made, the Flagstad Tristan, the Schwarzkopf Rosenkavalier, the Callous Carmen, has just issued one of the most grotesque records by an opera singer I've ever heard. Kiri sings Gershwin. Of course, there's always a problem when opera singers attempt popular music. Very few of them have ever been able to lighten up, to sound natural or free enough to bring it off. Kiri Takanawa, long before she sang at Princess Di's wedding or became a dame, made some passable records of show tunes in her native New Zealand. Lately she has turned to show music again, like the complete West Side Story conducted by Leonard Bernstein, which has met with extraordinary but to me inexplicable popular success. She may have one of the most beautiful soprano voices in the world, but popular music only compounds the problem she already has with opera. Her syrupy tone and stiff sense of rhythm, her too studied diction, and her inability to point words without coy overstatement when she points them at all, completely sink America's most buoyant composer, George Gershwin. Sometimes she sounds as if she hadn't the slightest idea what she was singing about, other times as if she were singing to four-year-olds. And her affectation of an American accent only exaggerates her distance from the idiom, a distance much further than New Zealand. There's barely an easy, spontaneous, or joyous note on this whole Gershwin album. Listen, for example, to this characteristically charmless, almost desperate version of "But Not For Me."
Sunshine, listen, you never tell me dreams come true. Just try it, and I'll start a riot. Beatrice Fairfax, don't you dare ever tell me he will care. I'm certain it's the final curtain. I never want to hear from any cheerful Pollyannas who tell you fate supplies a mate, it's all bananas. They're writing songs of love, but not for me. Ah, lucky stars above, but not for me. With love to lead the way, I found more skies of gray than any Russian play could guarantee. I was a fool to fall and get that way. Hey ho, alas, and all so lackaday. Love ain't done right by Nell, however, what the hell, I guess. Thank you.
Dame Kiri Tekanawa's attempt at Gershwin on a new Angel disc. I wish we could just dismiss this whole misguided effort, but there's some valuable material here. Conductor John McGlynn with the New Princess Theater Orchestra uses the newly rediscovered original orchestrations, and we get to hear most of the original lyrics, too. There's even the first recording of a long-lost song, the sweetly syncopated Meadow Serenade, written for Strike Up the Band, which exists today only because Gershwin's friend, composer Kay Swift, was able to transcribe it from memory. It's Dame Kiri's best moment. The arrangements of The Man I Love, I Got Rhythm, Embraceable You, and Nice Work If You Can Get It refreshingly convey the real Broadway and Hollywood of the 20s and 30s. But McGlynn doesn't understand Dame Kiri's voice. In his effort to recapture the lighter, jazzier style of the period, his faster-paced and insistent bounciness, even in the ballads, only seemed to rush her, which isn't a very stylish thing for any conductor to do. Fortunately, Angel has also issued a purely instrumental record of McGlynn doing Gershwin overtures and soundtrack music, again in original orchestrations, and it's a delight. Let's close with a bit of Stiff Upper Lip, the funhouse music from the 1937 film A Damsel in Distress, in which Fred Astaire danced with his second and third best partners, George Burns and Gracie Allen.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Kiri Sings Gershwin and Gershwin Overtures, both on the Angel record label. This is Fresh Air. My guest is cartoonist Matt Groening. He's best known for his syndicated cartoon strip, Life in Hell. Groening describes it as an amusing little trifle of a comic strip starring assorted crudely drawn rabbits. The strip appears in more than 60 newspapers. Most are alternative weeklies. Groening has compiled some of his strips in three books, Love is Hell, Work is Hell, and his latest, School is Hell. I'll let Groening describe his cast of characters.
I only draw rabbits. And a couple of humanoid figures. My main rabbit characters are Binky. He has very bulgy eyes, sort of a button nose, and extremely prominent teeth. He's based on a guy I went to college with. And then he has an illegitimate son named Bongo, and Binky's estranged girlfriend is named Sheba, who's basically Binky in drag. It's a part of a long tradition in cartooning to do female versions of the male characters just by giving them eyelashes and a bow on top of their heads. I'm thinking, of course, of Minnie Mouse and Daisy Duck. And then I have my two humanoid figures, Akbar and Jeff, who are either brothers or lovers, or perhaps both. And they wear fezes, and they have very big noses, and they have both eyes on the same side of their head. And they're based on a clumsy attempt at drawing Charlie Brown when I was a kid. My friends and I used to try to imitate the Peanut strip, and we could never get Charlie Brown to look anything like Charlie Brown, so it sort of mutated into Akbar and Jeff.
You make it sound like you don't draw very well.
Well, let me put it this way. No, I was the worst drawer of all my friends, but I stuck with it. Yeah, I'm slightly ashamed of my drawing. When I get together in a room full of cartoonists, I'm the one that is standing in the corner with my head hanging down.
Your new book is called School is Hell, and it's back to school time now. And while children are going back to school, adults are reminiscing about what their school days were like. Is School is Hell based on your memories of school?
Oh, certainly. I think that School is Hell is a pretty universal title, don't you? I mean,
yes.
If school was hell for me, and I think it was hell for virtually everybody who probably hears this. In fact, I think that if you don't think school was hell or is hell, then either you have a very bad memory or you're responsible for making school hell for someone else.
Well, look, if your basic premise is that life is hell, then it only follows that school is hell and work is hell and everything is hell.
Well, yeah. Yeah. But school really is hell. I mean, life is swell, but school, it's got some good points. But for the most part, I'm thinking of my own life experience. I was not guilty of a lot of the things I was accused of. I didn't drop the encyclopedia out the window. I didn't throw that rotten apple at Julie and hit her in the face when she had a broken leg. I didn't put up obscene posters around the school. And those were just the things that I was accused of that I wasn't guilty of that I got punished for. Just think of all the things that I was guilty of that I got punished for. I mean, it was endless, and I resented being punished for the things that I had done, but I really resented being punished for the things I hadn't done.
Were you ever punished for drawing cartoons in class?
Well, I had a teacher. In fact, it's referred to in my fifth grade diary in School is Hell. He liked to confiscate my cartoons. He'd wait until they were almost completed, and then he would snatch them from my desk.
You make him sound very sadistic.
Oh, no, he was really a nice guy. He was the guy that used to draw on the blackboard a little chalk circle and make me stick my nose on it when I had done something like talk during class or something like that. And the bad part wasn't so much having your nose stuck on the blackboard. It's when he raised the circle, inch by inch as the year wore on. And I wasn't growing at that quite a rate.
When did you start thinking seriously of being a cartoonist?
Well, my father was a cartoonist before I was born. He drew those kinds of cartoons where prospectors are crawling across the desert dying of thirst, and people are cast away on a desert island, and the bottles float up, and all those kinds of gags. So I think I got something from him. He also gave me a lot of marker pens. But like I said before, I never really could draw much of anything except rabbits, and so I had no idea that that I would do this as a career. Fortunately, I went to a really wild college, and that was called the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington, and that had no grades, no required courses, no tests, no fraternities, no sororities, no football team, and no jobs upon graduation. But the best thing about it was that it allowed me to do whatever I wanted to do. And one of the things I did was work on the school paper, and that's where I met another cartoonist, Linda Berry, who draws cartoons for Esquire and has a syndicated comic strip called Ernie Pook's Comique in papers around the country. And she and I cartooned together, and we stuck the cartoons in the paper, and that's basically how I got my start. She was my mentor. And tormentor, too.
You got your start in alternative papers, and as a matter of fact, you still are in a lot of alternative papers. How do you think the standards for cartoons differ between alternative papers and the dailies that carry comics?
Well, I never get censored in an alternative paper, and in some of the daily comic newspapers that I'm in, there is a little bit of pulling back. You can only push them so far, and then they'll get upset. In fact, one paper wanted me to change the title of my comic strip from Life in Hell to Life in Heck, because they thought it would just be a little too much for their readers.
You have a series of comics of covers of specialty magazines that you've invented. One of them is called Annoying Street Lunatic, which is a magazine for the homeless, and you call it America's fastest growing magazine. Another magazine that you've invented is Starving Artist Magazine, and one of the lead stories is how to cope with reading about wildly successful artists who are younger than you are. You make fun a lot of tortured, sensitive artists and striving artists. Have you ever thought of yourself as a starving artist?
Starving, yes. You know, I sort of made this vow a long time ago that I would not use the word art in conjunction with cartoons, because it seems like every time people talk about cartooning and they have to justify it to other people, they always say, oh, well, cartooning is literature or cartooning is art or whatever. And in my opinion, cartooning ain't art, ain't literature. It's just cartoons, and it's peripheral stuff. Cartoonists are not ready for some of the more sophisticated art forms, and they tend to resent serious art because it's not wacky enough. And so they do go through life. I'm, of course, not like that at all. They do go through with life vaguely resentful and kind of squinting at the rest of the world as it goes by, ignoring them.
Recently, you started doing animation for the Tracy Ullman Show. How does the animation that you're doing compare to the comics that you do?
With the drawing, it's just me sitting alone at a desk, you know, trying to keep the sweat from dripping off the end of my nose onto the page. And with an animated cartoon, I work with lots and lots of people, and it's definitely a collaborative effort.
How do the characters you've created for that compare to the rabbits that you do in your cartoons?
Well, they have the same bulgy eyes, and they have the same little button cute noses, and they have the same kind of very tragic overbite. But they don't have the big ears, except perhaps the mom, who has a giant bouffant hairdo, and she probably is concealing rabbit ears underneath. Perhaps in the last show I will reveal that she's actually a rabbit. It's a family called the Simpsons. Bart Simpson, Lisa Simpson, Maggie Simpson, and mom and dad, and they're sort of mutant 50s, father's knows best family in hell. It's sort of a running theme in my stuff.
Is being a cartoonist hell?
Not at all. I had to be a cartoonist or something equally frivolous. And so every day that I'm able to sit down and get to draw goofy, bulgy-eyed rabbits instead of something else, I feel very lucky.
Matt Groening, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Matt Groening spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. His new collection of cartoons is called School is Hell.
Well, school days, dear old golden rule days, reading and writing and arithmetic, taught to the tune of a hickory stick. I was your bashful favorite beau, and you was my girl in Calico. Humpty, Humpty Dumpty, he sat up on the wall. Yeah, Humpty.
You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are coming up?
Well, Congress came back into session today, and so we've asked congressional reporter Linda Wertheimer, our very own, what's on the agenda. She says a couple of the hot topics will be aid to the Contras and Supreme Court nominee Robert Bork. His confirmation hearings will start this coming week. Also today, we look back at the Constitutional Convention. 200 years ago, it turns out, we were less than a week away from the actual signing of the document, and the delegates had not yet figured out how the president was going to be chosen.
Who are you talking to today?
I'm speaking with writer Linda Hazelstrom, who's just published her diary detailing a year in the life of a ranch on the prairies of South Dakota.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Today, our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg, recently back from a visit to France, continues his series of observations by an American linguist abroad. In this installment, he tells us that American words and expressions have increasingly infiltrated the French vocabulary, and French authorities are rallying against them.
My French has never been anything to write home about. And each successive visit to France is like a trip to the dentist, which reveals new decay and further cavities. Fortunately, the French have been quite obliging over the years. It seems as if half the French words I've forgotten have been replaced by English since last I was here. Did I used to know the French word for news, boss, or show business? No matter. Nowadays, the French say le news, le boss, and le showbiz. No wonder I find it easy to read a French newspaper these days when a story talks about le packaging sexy des gadgets et des t-shirts avec des photos des superstars du hit parade. Needless to say, however, the powers that be in France are not entirely pleased with this tendency. In the latest blow in their long battle against this hybrid franglais, they've tried to limit the amount of radio airplay allowed for English language songs. But moves like that aren't likely to accomplish much, so long as most young French people consider the use of English words, as they put it, super cool. There are basically two reasons why speakers of one language borrow words from another. Sometimes new words are borrowed along with new things. We have taken a lot of our food and fashion from the French, and we've taken a lot of their words in the process, from hors d'oeuvre to entree and from lingerie to barrette. Nowadays, of course, the espadrille's most often on the other foot. It's the Americans who are coining most of the new technical terms that are being adopted in other languages, and it's our food and our fashions that foreigners are taking on, which is why the French now talk about le hamburger, le blue jean, and le t-shirt. Now, in most nations, people don't get worked up about this sort of borrowing. It's natural enough to borrow names along with things, to call hibachis hibachis or fettuccine fettuccine. But the French authorities have tried to circle the wagons even here. In fact, they've gone so far as to specify a whole alternative vocabulary to be used to refer to things like computers, software, and chips, whereas most other languages are perfectly happy to use the English terms. This seems a little excessive to me, but then what would you expect from the people who gave the word chauvinist to the world? But I can see why the French linguistic Brahmins should be concerned about another sort of borrowing. Sometimes the prestige of one culture becomes so dominant that speakers of other languages will start borrowing foreign words to describe things for which they already have their own words. At one time, French culture had this kind of prestige, which is why we took to saying things like politesse in place of politeness or rendezvous in place of meeting. But now it's the French who are talking about going to le meeting in order to get to le top of le job. In what has to be the most striking example to an English speaker, you even hear French people abandoning their traditional oh la la in favor of the hottest new English borrowing, wow. No wonder the authorities are worried. Once the word gets out that the French now eat hamburgers, dress in blue jeans, and no longer say oh la la, what's going to happen to the tourist trade? Not to worry. The French are still relentlessly, hopelessly French, and still proud of it. Even as they take over American words, they give them a characteristically Gallic je ne sais quoi. Their blue jeans are cut with a notable différence, and their merchandising sexy is certainly not the kind of thing you're likely to run into on an American billboard. If I may offer one word of advice to the French Academy, it would be, as the French say nowadays, relax.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Next time, I'll speak with film producer Ishmael Merchant. He collaborated with director James Ivory on such films as The Bostonians and Room with a View. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review the new novelty record, Elvis is Everywhere, by Skid Roper and Mojo Nixon. And film critic Stephen Schiff will review A Prayer for the Dying, starring Mickey Rourke, Alan Bates, and Bob Hoskins. It's about an IRA gunman who tries to leave that group. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional help from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.